This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay respects to elders past, present and emerging, and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters and culture. Colonization and genocide are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded. This always was, and always will be, Aboriginal land.
Hello, and welcome to Auspol Snack Pod, the weekly podcast where we bring you bite-sized chunks of Australian politics and news with a side of crispy memes. And we're also the official podcast of the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group, which you can join at facebook.com/groups/Auspol Shitposting. My name's Noon. I'm the admin and creator of Auspol Shitposting, and joining me via non-contagious video link.
Hey, Zach Lesnack. Apologies if we are talking over each other and all that, because we both have absolutely dog shit internet connections. So
it's really lucky that our government built a functional NBN before the entire workforce needed to work from home and be constantly streaming video all day.
Well, that's the effective forethought and strong action that we've come to expect of successive Australian governments.
That's very true.
Yeah.
Some people who do have good forethought, economic insight, and who we could trust to build an NBN are our patrons. We've got three new patrons, Eileen, Daisy, and Steph. So thank you all very much for joining the Snack Pod Patreon. And also thanks to Jess, who has been a patron for ages and ages and ages, but has upgraded to a $10 amount. So she's going to get our cool new Snack Pod merch with our toast on a pin.
Yeah, it's cool. It means a lot always when anybody signs up to our Patreon, but especially at a time like this when people are struggling and things are uncertain, it really is very moving to have people offer their support to us. So thank you so much.
Totally.
And yeah, if you're keen to help us out and you can afford to do so, you can sign up to our Patreon for as little as $1 a month and get a monthly bonus episode plus a bunch of other cool shit. And yeah, the higher tiers have other stuff, as Noon said, including our cool new pin. So check it out. Noon, do you want to get into our entree? I know that you love talking about elections so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for some fucking reason, Queensland is holding their local council elections today as we're recording. So this is Saturday the 28th. Your listeners will be hearing this from tomorrow, so the results should probably be already out. But because of the whole, you know, coronavirus situation, there's been more than half of the population of Queensland who either voted early or by post. But nonetheless, there's going to be a huge number of Queenslanders all standing in like really tight lines, using the same little pencils to fill out the forms and shit. It just seems like maybe it's a bad idea.
It's like their official comment was like, oh, it's no worse than going to the supermarket and standing in line there. And it's like, well, people probably shouldn't really be doing that either.
Oh, that
we're
telling everyone not to do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Their chief medical officer seems to be quite blasé about this, from what I've read.
Yeah. I can understand wanting to do the elections. Like, I'm pretty worried that Trump is going to cancel the 2020 general election. But yeah, I don't know. For all that local council is very important, and I support it, and it can be effective, and people can get involved with it way more than other levels or whatever, it's also not like necessarily the like cornerstone of Australian democratic like efficacy or whatever. Like, it might be fine to just hang on until September or October when Queensland has a state election and presumably the whole virus situation will be at least more clear, if not, like, resolved.
Yeah, well, they're definitely taking it less seriously than other states. New South Wales was supposed to have their state elections, I think, in September, and those have been postponed. So,
right.
Yeah, I don't know. It's definitely a weird move that seems... I'm not sure what the motivation behind it is beyond... Yeah, I mean, I really don't know. It's just a general sense of, like, people not taking it that seriously, I guess.
Yeah. Yep. Anyway, that's basically all Queensland is going to a local council election for some reason. So yeah, eye on results, I guess.
And if you're in Queensland, yeah, hope you manage to vote early and stay safe.
For real. Actually, yeah, results might not be out tomorrow because of all the postals and stuff. It might be some time till we find out what happened. There's also a couple of by-elections going on. Anyway, Zach, do you want to take us through the First Nations story?
Sure. So this is yet another corona-related story. So this is a story from the Northern Territory about an organization called CALIS. That's an acronym for the Central Australian Youth Link-Up Service, who they basically operate in the bottom half of the Northern Territory, and they operate under the auspice of the Tangentieri Council. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's around the Alice Springs area, basically. And they've got a steering committee that's made up of a whole bunch of different First Nations-led community and health organizations. So they were founded about 18 years ago, I think it was, in order to specifically combat an epidemic of petrol sniffing and amongst young people. And they've since branched out into a whole bunch of other community initiatives. And there was just a story in the ABC this week that we thought was really nice, which was about the work that CALIS is doing, trying to spread awareness of the best way to combat coronavirus amongst First Nations youth. So one of the things that they have to contend with is a huge amount of misinformation. Apparently there are rumors going around that Aboriginal people are not susceptible to the virus. So that's obviously something that they have to contend with. But they've come up with a bunch of methods for encouraging people to learn about the virus and how best to behave in order to stop its spread. A bunch of ways that I think are quite creative and
totally.
and nice. So they've basically been encouraging forms of learning that are interactive and encourage people to actually use the knowledge as opposed to just kind of passively receive it. So they've got things like playing social distancing versions of Bulldog, and there's like they've got like a dance and selfie challenge. They're giving away like one phone every month to the the best social media video about washing your hands and not touching your face and coughing into your arm and that kind of thing. It's just I guess nice to see some different approaches to trying to educate vulnerable populations about this kind of thing.
Totally. And I think the work that organizations that are like integrated with the community do as far as how they try and connect with people just illustrate so much more how badly our like institutionalized attempts of reaching those same goals are. And like, we talked about the Closing the Gap report a little while ago about education and so on, that like, I'm skeptical about whether graduating year 12 through a like mainstream Western high school is necessarily like the style of education most appropriate to people who are living in remote communities. And something that's super cool about CALIS is that they clearly are so aware of who the people are they're working with and how they can communicate with them and how those people are learning and that sort of thing. So I just think that's really cool that they, clearly on the ball with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think part of what's really great about this is that it is coming from community workers and people who do have relationships and can build trust with the kids in these communities, as opposed to this kind of government-led, top-down dissemination of health information. Because the workers who have relationships with the people in these communities obviously have a much higher amount of trust and are going to be listened to. And I just wanted to read a quote here from Blair McFarland, who is the head of CALIS. And he says, "Youth programs in the 20 remote communities in our region should be viewed as essential services during the coming months, as they will be important vehicles for health messaging, hygiene, keeping kids out of trouble, and feeding people." So yeah, the fact that these youth organizations are actually better placed to deliver this really vital health and hygiene messaging, I think just says a lot about the importance of community work and how valuable it is. And
totally.
And as you say, Noon also points to the shortcomings of our colonial government in reaching people with this vital information, especially at a time of crisis.
All right. I think that might be enough about that. So why don't you line up our new sting?
This is the silliest sting we've done. But I'll play it for you.
Thanks.
Hey, man, I got some more beers.
Oh, I don't know if I can drink anymore. I'm feeling kind of sick.
No, come on, we're having another round of Coronas.
We should really just, like, have that at the start of the episode. Like, I mean, already both of our stories that weren't another round of Coronas were Corona related, but I guess that's just the world we live in now.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to keep up with the news on this stuff. The developments have been so quick. The situation is really very different from what we talked about just a week ago. And in fact, it was like
absolutely
the day that we put out our last episode, the government made a whole bunch of new announcements in regards to welfare that basically completely contradicted everything that we'd said on the show. So that's sick.
That's news, baby.
That is how the news goes. Just off the top, quickly, last week when we were talking about coronavirus, there had been around 900 recorded cases, maybe just under 1,000. And this week we're up to 3,500. So, you know, this stuff is spreading very fast and obviously the situation is very different. But so we talked a fair amount last week about the government's response with regards to welfare, and that there were plans to, as we thought at the time, introduce a higher rate for new job seekers than existing job seekers.
That was the plan, by the way. They did walk that back. That wasn't just a complete fabrication.
We weren't wrong about it.
It is good to know
it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But so this is obviously a positive thing. They haven't gone with that they're going to double New Start basically for 6 months for everybody who's on the job seeker payment. But when they announced this last Sunday, I think it was, there were a bunch of people left off the increased payment, and most of those people were students. So people who are on Ab Study or Oz Study or Youth Allowance for students weren't going to get the payment. And then there was a little bit of uproar about that. And then later in the week, they changed their tune and said, no, all of those student payments are going to be included. So they've expanded that, which is good. But it is important to note that there's an important category of people that have been left off this supplement payment, this supplement coronavirus payment. And those are pensioners, people either on the disability pension or the old age pension. So, I mean, that makes little to no fucking sense to me at all. We're obviously... Mm-hmm. I don't know. I suppose it's this assumption of like, oh, well, you're already living on this payment because you're already unemployed because you're not useful to a capitalist society.
Totally.
So I guess we don't need to.
You must just continue being fine like this. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that's the only possible logic behind it, aside from the, obviously the cold logic of just cutting corners and saving money and dragging the government, dragging their feet at every point in the introduction of these.
I think also, this is maybe getting into the category of our blurred take, but I think the big influx of new people into New Start or Job Seeker as it is now means that there's now so much more momentum for that. Whereas disability, there's not actually going to be barely any new people being added onto it. So a ditto old age, it's not going to expand in the same way that New Start or Job Seeker has. So the like social force and leverage and so on of those two groups has remained the same.
I think that's a good point, and that definitely points towards why solidarity is so important, because the government will try to split us and fuck over anybody that they can. So we obviously need to stand together, and people who have received this increased rate, and that's great, you know, great work by welfare advocates, especially want to shout out the Australian Unemployed Workers Union. But and they themselves have actually been very clear on this. So like we need to keep fighting for everybody to get this. So you know, it's very important that we look out for those who the government is attempting to leave behind. And so now it's time for
You Fucked Up.
So you mentioned noon, the massive influx of people to Centrelink, because obviously we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people suddenly unemployed and now applying for these new payments. And on the morning that these new payments were introduced, the Centrelink website went down. So anybody who's had any experience with MyGov in the past will be absolutely shocked to hear this, because as we all know, it's an absolutely bulletproof piece of web design and development that
completely
has functioned basically
intuitive, accessible.
Yeah, it's a seamless kind of glowing sphere of online genius that has provided for all Australians as far as we can remember. So it was really weird to see it break under this minimal amount of extra strain.
Yep.
Yeah. So, of course, it makes sense that the Human Services Minister, Stuart Robert, would assume that this was the result of a malicious cyber attack. Specifically, a denial of service attack where you get a whole bunch of people to go to a website at the same time in order to try and make it crash. Which, now
you mean
it out loud,
something that would look very similar to how a bunch of new welfare applicants might look, for example.
Yeah. Strange. Something that might happen if 95,000 people tried to go to a website at the same time.
That was designed for 6,000, yeah.
That he was wrong or lying, and neither of those are great. So,
no. Well, he did later say it was my bad. So, you know.
Yeah, he walked it back. Like,
that doesn't really tell us whether it was a lie or wrong. But
what
it
he
was
said
his
was
bad. That's true.
He walked it back like literally like 4 hours later because no one else in the government was backing him up. And in question time, I think what he said was basically, yeah, sorry, it wasn't that it was a denial of service attack. It just looked like a denial of service attack because we had so many people trying to use the website. So I don't know what the fuck that he was thinking, but this is not a guy who has a history of not fucking up.
Yes.
You remember him from, it was like 2 years ago and it came out. At the time when there was a whole bunch of like government entitlement stuff MP entitlement stuff going on, people misusing public funds, and it came out that he had charged taxpayers almost $38,000 for internet data, and when pressed on it, he was
really
like,
incredible.
Just personal use. Yeah, how the fuck do you rack up that kind of a bill? I don't know.
You
like,
have to be streaming like Ultra HD VR. Without a Wi-Fi connection or like with the worst possible plan. Like maybe he's got like 1 gig of data and just like blows over it in the first hour and a half each month.
He's getting charged $10 per gigabyte by Optus.
Emoji he uses or whatever.
Used to happen to me. Yeah. So he's no stranger to fucking up. Yeah, I mean, who knows what he was using the internet for? He was made to pay it all back. But, just another stellar example of a government minister doing their job excellently, holding up well under the pressure. Things bode well for the future.
Something I wanted to say about the welfare as well is that people may know that all of these, like, corona supplements and stuff are starting from the end of the month, from the 1st of April. And the reason for that, or so it's speculated by the commentariat, is that the government wants to put all of the expenditure in next quarter's budget figures because the definition of a recession, so what people call a technical recession because it's, like, the definition of it, is that there's negative growth for 2 quarters. And I'm pretty sure this would be the 2nd quarter. So they're trying to put all of this big splurge not on the budget sheet for this month so that they can avoid a technical recession. But obviously that's fucking stupid because who knows what's going to be going on in like another week. Presumably a lot more of the economy is going to be shut down and it's going to be much harder for people to like spend that money. So...
And what if someone does an April Fool's denial of service prank? Could be a disaster.
We should. That sounds like a great idea. Apparently, it's really easy. You just have to have like a service that people have need for.
Yeah, and like a population desperately affected by a crisis. Shouldn't be too hard to find. Probably the one other thing to mention about this was that... obviously, there are huge delays in people being able to contact Centrelink and especially in getting that money. And there's like estimated wait times of like 6 weeks in some cases before people be able to actually get their hands on the money. But they have introduced a new feature where you can lodge your intent to claim. So if you're thinking about applying for JobSeeker under these new conditions, but
it'll
the
get
whole
back
thing
paid
sounds
from
like
the date you click that button.
Exactly. Even if it seems like a huge hassle, it's a good idea to just lodge that intent to claim now and try and get the process started.
Yep.
So, following on from this, now it's time for...
It was the best of
takes.
It was the blurst of
takes.
You stupid monkey!
So, Noon, do you want to take us through this one?
Sure. So, happily, this week we've got a blessed take, which is nice because the blurst takes are always really bad. This is a tweet from Richard Cook, who's
the... That's why they win.
US... Oh, yeah. Pardon? That's why they win, yeah. That's right. We really, yeah, made ourselves put up a lot of bad content with that segment concept. But anyway, Richard Cook is the US editor for the monthly magazine, and he tweeted this. Many systems failing because they're being used by the, quote, wrong people. Welfare is punitive, not distributive. Border forces for asylum seekers, not cruise ship passengers. I think that's really good. And there's a photo of, you know, the big queue around Centrelink offices. And I think that's such a good point. And like the, as we were sarcastically saying before, the MyGov website is a complete load of crap. And it's because it's supposed to be used by the worst possible imaginable people, i.e. those without jobs. And nothing needs to be easy or convenient or well organized for them. And in fact, it needs to be the opposite so that they can have a Kafka real life, you know. And the same thing with the cruise ship. So this is a reference to the Ruby Princess, which probably most listeners know was a cruise ship that docked in Sydney Harbour with a bunch of people who had coronavirus who were, and this was after there was a regulation specifically banning cruise ships from docking, which is just insane. But yeah, the ship docked, passengers got off and they were basically told like, hey, you have to mandatorily self-isolate. And they were like, huh? Yeah. All right. And like stopped off for a snack on the way home and went shopping and bought toilet paper if they could and so on. And a lot of them didn't then self-isolate in the way that they were supposed to. And the point that Richard Cook is making is that Border Force is not designed to be like protecting the biosecurity of Australia or like the security at all. It's designed to terrify and intimidate and torture asylum seekers.
Right. Just like Centrelink is built in order to be as cumbersome and infuriating to use as possible in order to try and discourage people from claiming welfare. Yeah. Weird how if you specifically design a system that is hard to use, it's going to be hard to use when people need it.
And I got to say, look, honestly, in Australia, I'm glad it's our, like, welfare thing failing rather than, like, Medicare and that NHS in the UK or the US, like, oh, God, at least we have, like, a relatively functional system of GPs and hospitals. But anyway, also, shout-outs to any health professionals listening. Thank you so much for what you're doing.
Big time. All right, now it's time for...
Shitpost of the Week.
And this one is going to a first-time winner, Jim Bellina, who has been pretty active in the group recently. This was a post in Auspol Shitposting and interestingly, I think this is the first time that we've given something both a shitpost and a shitpost, as listeners, long-time listeners will know, because I think it's been a while since we've had a shit post, but yeah, sometimes we have good posts, sometimes we have bad posts. This one is both. So Jim Bellina says, another controversial question, ... When all this blows over, will the left be more divided than it was last year? And the image with it is Batman slapping Robin with the, like, extendo arm, the social distancing Batman slap meme.
Great format, great template.
Yeah, it's excellent. And so Robin here, who presumably is like a left unity guy, is saying, Christopher Pine is selling military secrets to Ernst & Young. And Batman slaps him in the face with the extendo arm thing and says, Pa! Jordan Shanks is the devil!
It's pretty good. The other thing
Zach
I like about this
was a little confused
meme,
about this one.
Yeah, initially I was like, well, I don't totally understand who's supposed to be who in this situation, but... You are theorizing it. Basically, Robin is somebody trying to do actual work, and Batman represents theoretically the members of Auspol Shitposting being like, hey, I don't want to do work. All I want to do is split the left. And also, Friendly Geordies is a fuckwit, which, you know, is true.
It's true.
Yeah, and this post seems to be like at least vaguely implicitly pro Friendly Geordies, which is why we have to also call it a shit post as well as a shit post. And the other thing I love about this one is that it's getting ratioed. It's got about 7 likes, but like 20 comments, which is, you know, is always a sign of like a thought-provoking, controversial Batman slap meme.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you, Jim. And also, come on, Jim. Both. You get both. So yeah, thanks very much. Keep on posting. We love it, even if we also think Jordan Shanks is the devil.
But, you know, it's an interesting conversation, I suppose, around, like, is this a time that is going to bring people together on the quote-unquote left, or is it going to be something that splits us down the middle? Are we going to let the government and other forces separate us? So this is a question that brings us to our Positivity Corner segment. Positivity Corner. As we mentioned up the top of the podcast, we've had a little bit of an outpouring of support from people this week. We've had a number of people sign up to our Patreon, which has been really lovely, and we've gotten a number of really nice messages of support as well, people enjoying the podcast while they're social isolating and all that. So that has been hugely positive for us. It's a little bit, obviously, I don't know, looking inwards, I suppose, for the positive thing to be about ourselves, but we couldn't find anything else super compelling. But we do genuinely, in the news, but we do genuinely appreciate and feel, you know, so kind of supported by the community. And in general, beyond, you know, the podcast and the group and stuff, it's actually been really nice to look around and see all kinds of community support popping up all over the place. There's mutual aid groups that you see on Facebook, fundraisers for at-risk communities like the National Homeless Collective.
And for supporting sex workers and so on, yeah.
So in general, there has been, you know, a really lovely kind of community response to this crisis, which has been really nice to see. So that's been obviously super positive as well. And to kind of follow along from those two things, we thought that we might try something different with Positivity Corner and ask you what's been your silver lining of this whole situation. What are the things that you've been seeing that in response to the crisis that have made you feel good about people and community? Or what are the ways that you are enjoying having to spend more time at home? I don't know if you're cooking a new meal or working on your sourdough, as everybody on Twitter seems to be doing. I know you're getting into the bread game noon. I personally
been
have
pumping
been...
pumping out those bagels. They're pretty good.
Yeah, your bagels are so good. I feel positive about your bagels. But please... over the next 2 weeks, we would love it if you would record just a super short snippet, like call it 10, 15 seconds of audio of yourself talking about something that's made you feel good amongst the recent chaos and the upsetting news. And we'll put together a little compilation and play it on the show in a fortnight. We won't do it next week because we're bringing you something different, which we'll talk to you about at the end of the episode. Please send us your Positivity Corner tips and we'll play them on the show.
Cool. Thanks for that one, Zach. And thanks in advance, listeners, for telling us what's so positive about this. I think it's now time for us to move on to our main course. And this week we're going to be having utopian waffles.
Sounds good. There was a... I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks ago when you did the intro to the show. It was your turn to do the intro, and you said, you gave me a compliment. You know, we've been trying to do a thing where we like are positive about each other at the beginning of the show, which I really enjoy. And you said
it's
something about enjoying my perspective, and I responded kind of flippantly, I like being the dunce to your smart guy, which I think you were like, oh, I was just trying to give you a compliment.
Yeah.
And I was like, ha. I was only being slightly facetious. One of my favorite things to do on this show is to just hand over a segment to Noon, who knows about so much stuff, and listen to him talk about it and try to interject with a couple of gags here and there. So that's going to be the format of this week's mains. So Noon, do you want to take it away?
Yeah, except I just wanted to say that presumably every time you interject with a gag, it's going to like fuck up the recording and we're going to have to like talk about it for a minute and then say that sentence again because this internet connection is real bad. But anyway, listeners, I hope that by the time this is all gone through the edit, it all sounds completely smooth and you're just hearing us complain about the internet with no understanding of why that is the case. But anyway, Yeah, so I wanted to talk about a book called Inventing the Future by Nick Cernicek and Alex Williams. It's kind of about the book, but this was a book that was written kind of in response to Occupy, the Occupy movement and the global financial crisis. And basically they were like, Occupy fucked up a bunch of stuff. This is what the left should be doing. And, you know, there's problems with it. I don't like wholeheartedly endorse everything that they say, but I think that some of the proposals that they talk about are super relevant in the sort of world of coronavirus. And that's why I wanted to discuss it today. Things that I see happening in the corona economy, I guess you'd call it, are telecommuting, so, you know, working from home, the vastly reduced amount of work that's going on. So obviously at the moment that's sort of pretty traumatic, people being unemployed, but I think it's still relevant. And the corollary of that, which is the increase in welfare, both like amount and who's eligible for it and all this other stuff. So I probably won't actually talk about the coronavirus situation a whole lot more throughout the rest of this section, but I just want to like let listeners kind of understand that I'm not just like picking this random book to talk about, that there's specific reasons that I think that it's relevant at this moment.
For sure. This is an attempt, I suppose, to try to get ahead of the conversation a little bit. You know, we are scrambling to keep up with the developments about the coronavirus because the situation is developing so quickly. And we thought it would be nice to talk about what things might sort of look like afterwards, what are ways that the left could potentially take advantage of this situation and not let these short-term gains kind of relapse or go to waste. So this is a bit of a kind of, yeah, looking forward. But to be clear, I haven't read this book. Noon very optimistically sent me a lovingly hand-scanned PDF of someone who just like scanned all 260 pages of this book into a document and then sent it to me one day before we were supposed to record, which was, yeah, very sweet and thoughtful. And also I didn't read any of it. So
completely unhelpful. Yeah. Look, in my defense, I've been low key telling you to read this book for like 3 or 4 years, but anyway,
that's definitely true.
Sent you in our Google Hangout chat a link so you can buy it.
Oh, there it is. You came through. All right, I've got no excuse now. All right, we'll talk about it in a year when I get through it.
Except that it's like long and dense. Yeah. So I'll just start off with this quote from page 8485. The left needs to reclaim the contested legacy of modernity and advance visions for a new future. Just as the right foreshadowed the crisis of the 1970s and prepared a full-spectrum set of responses, so too should the left prepare for the coming crisis of work and surplus populations. And then from a bit later on, none of the proposals will be radically new, but this is part of their strength. It's not a free-floating project, since frameworks and movements already exist and have traction in the world. So that's basically the goal of the book, is to encourage the left to not only have a reactive approach, so like this thing is fascist and we need to oppose it, and also not only to have kind of what they call folk politics responses. And so this is, I guess, the stuff that maybe like the mutual aid thing is covered by it, but what they're really talking about is Occupy, right? So Occupy was aggressively anti-hierarchical and really this wasn't true of all of them because it was a decentralized, group, but many Occupy organizations refused to put forward demands. And they were saying basically like, it's all fucked. No demand is going to cover this. And so the perception was that refusing to make demands was in some sense more radical than making demands. And the authors of Inventing of the Future solidly reject that. And they basically, I couldn't actually find the quote where they talk about this, but they talk about this idea of non-reformist reforms. And by that they mean things that would be implementable under capitalism and under, you know, parliamentary democracy that aren't sort of obviously going to, it's not like, let's legislate full socialism or let's legislate private property no longer exists or something like that. So not really extreme proposals, they're reforms, not revolutions. But they call them non-reformist because they think that together these three or four goals will push capitalism outside of the boundaries that it currently occupies and outside of boundaries that it can sustain itself with?
No, Nuna, I'm sorry, but I think you'll find that it's either reform or revolution, and there's absolutely nothing in between those two. And if you're trying to find nuance, I think you'll find that it literally doesn't exist and that you are a trot.
Yes, well, it wouldn't be the first time that I've been called a trot. But
because you've been internet before.
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah. Because I'm willing to criticize North Korea about certain issues. Yeah.
Oh, my. Where's your solidarity, dude? I got to say, I really enjoyed you swinging the mod hammer and shutting down a tanky thread in the group this week. That was,
There's been like six.
You were just like, no tanky threads.
Yeah. Well, it's like, because I forgot that I made the rule about no tanky threads because people were getting seriously upset, and I want to respect that and make Oz Bullshit Posting a group where people won't feel upset about seeing the threads there. But also, I like get involved with them when they happen, and I'm like, hey, I've got opinions about this, and both of you are wrong, blah, 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 and getting called a trut. And so I've just had to be like, no, I've got a rule. I'm just logging the comments regardless of what I think. So anyway, yeah.
Very fair, applying, living by your own rules there. Gotta respect it.
So, non-reformist reforms. Yeah, I think that they are exciting because I think for a lot of people, the idea of like a violent revolution is maybe not nice, which it shouldn't be, or it's not feasible, which I think is definitely, there's an argument to be made for that in like, you know, modern Australia. I don't think there's much of a chance of like a violent overthrow of the government. So, yeah, I think having some kind of conceptual framework to look for things that can be implemented legislatively but will have a systemic and fundamental effect. And the four demands that they make in this book are, one, full automation or reduction of labor demand, and I'll go through these in more detail, but two, full unemployment, which is to say reduction of labor supply. Three is a universal basic income, and four is a diminishing or destroying of the work ethic. And I think these four are all really interesting. So it's probably immediately apparent that they're basically thinking about a post-work world of some sort. And this is a very common sort of catch cry amongst particularly anarchists and other sorts of like libertarian socialists, that sort of thing, that like the idea of work as like drudgery and unnecessary bullshit. And this is something very close to my heart. One of the few politics theory books that you have read on my recommendation, Zach, was one that you then mercilessly made fun of me for, which was called Work by Crime Think Ex-Workers Collective. Do you want to tell us about that?
Oh, sure. Look, I mean, that was a book put together by they're basically like an anarchist collective, right?
Yeah, they're an anti-work collective.
Ex-workers collective. Yeah, and there was some really good stuff in there, and I read it like at my job on my lunch breaks, which I did enjoy.
Nice.
And it was just, yeah, basically like destroying the concept of work as a good and necessary thing. And there was a lot of really good stuff in there, but every second page was just an extremely shit photocopied handmade meme on some real, like, hey, have you ever noticed how these two words look similar? And that probably means that there's some kind of link between them. And the result of that is that working is bad.
I remember you saying it was like a 200 page long zine.
Yeah, it will.
Which is about right.
That is exactly,
that was exactly the
that's exactly
it
what it is. But the description of work that basically you just outlined, that it is like pointless drudgery and that it is something that literally crushes your spirit and makes you depressed, is something that I think is very true and well outlined in that book. So
yes, they do make a convincing argument for that. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And like, this is not a fucking, it might be, I suppose, a kind of radical concept in the sense that it's very deeply entrenched in our kind of societal fabric, that that work is inherently in and of itself a positive or good thing. But it's not a radical idea when you talk to most people about their jobs.
Yeah.
Almost everybody who's ever worked will be able to tell you, well, they'll tell you that, no, my job's shit. Like, if you say to someone, oh, I had a bad day at work, and they're like, oh, like, why was it bad? It's like, well, work sucks. Like, I don't think that that's an alien concept. So the idea of using this as a kind of linchpin around which to organize an effective leftist movement makes a lot of sense. Like, you know, I'm reinventing the wheel here. That's what I'm doing. But, like, all I'm saying is, sounds good.
Maybe you're reinventing the future.
Whoa!
Yeah, but I also think it's worth pointing out that, like, this anti-work stuff isn't anti-effort. That's an important distinction, and I think that's probably pretty obvious to everyone listening who's not, like, approaching this with ears carefully shut. But, like, a lot of people work in a particular field because they find it meaningful or because it has some impact that they believe in or whatever, but then all of the stuff that they have to do in order to make that impact is fucking awful. There's a great podcast called Ologies where Ali Ward interviews a scientist each week, and each week she asks them this question. You know, she asks them a bunch of other stuff. One of the questions is, what's the worst thing about your job? And something like 80% of them, and these are people from very, very different fields, you know, there's astronomers and biologists and chemists and
mushroom experts,
philosophers and all sorts of stuff, and nearly all of them say it's the fucking emails. I get so many useless emails, and I think, yeah, that's indicative that, like, probably most of those people would be doing that same work even if they weren't being paid for it or, like, you know, if they could, but that they wouldn't do all of the bullshit that surrounds it. So, anyway, yeah, I think that's just important to distinguish between work and effort.
Oh, for sure. And so, the Capitalist Realism by Mark Fisher, which you also recommended to me, and that's another one of the books he recommended that I actually did read.
That's true, you got through that.
Yeah, I read it in like 2 days. It was really good. Speaks a lot in that book about his perspective from the experience of being a school teacher and basically how much capitalism has just enforced all of this bullshit self-surveillance in universities.
Yeah.
So that people spend way more time basically trying to make it look like they're doing effective teaching than they are actually teaching. And I think that this is a phenomenon, as you say, that you can observe, like, basically all across the workforce.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just wanted to go through these goals in a little bit more detail and maybe tie them a bit to the corona situation. So full automation is the first one, and that's pretty obvious. And so I should also say that when they say full automation, full unemployment, that's kind of not accurate. They're saying we should be aiming for these things and we won't get all the way there. And the point is made about full unemployment that, like, at the moment in, like, modern capitalist economies, the government's aiming for full employment. But in practice, they have a unemployed percentage of between, like, 3 to 10 to 15, or, you know, depending on what country it is and what time, what year. But the goal is ostensibly to have zero unemployment. And they make the point that that's actually not possible under capitalism. Capitalism requires what Marx calls a reserve army of labor, which is, like, unemployed people that can basically represent a threat to the workers. So if you're working a shitty job and you ask for better conditions, the boss can fire you and get someone from the reserve army of labor. So capitalism requires people to be unemployed in order to have control over the working class.
Damn, shit. Sounds like you're saying it's a bad, cruel system?
Sounds like you're some kind of commie hippie, Zach. You probably don't even like working pointless jobs.
I am actually wearing shorts with the hammer and sickle on them right now. When I went to a costume party dressed as Ivan Drago from Rocky IV.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little homemade hammer and sickle. It's very cute. Sorry, go on.
I think actually that's a really good point, is to draw a distinction between this and, like, pro-Soviet communism or whatever, because obviously in the Soviet Union people were working and were also being given bullshit jobs for, like, numbers reasons and so on. It's not like this is what previous examples of communism were or whatever either. Anyway, so full employment, definitely a myth. Full unemployment, equally a myth, but a much better one for what we should be collectively aiming for. Like, doesn't it make sense to aim for a world where no one has to get up and do anything if they don't want to, and instead everyone spends all of their time doing what is meaningful and valuable to them? And
hippie.
I think where this tie... Yeah, go on, sorry.
I just called you a hippie.
Oh, yeah, yeah, thanks. Yeah. So what has been shown in the coronavirus situation is that we do have people whose work cannot be avoided, and medical professionals are the main ones there, but obviously there's a whole lot of others, school teachers, supermarket workers, and truckers. There's all sorts of people who have to be out at work right now. And I think that the way in which we've shut down non-essential parts of the economy show that actually we can live a good life without everyone going and doing everything every day, all of the shit that everyone does all day every day. Like, it's not really that necessary for the most part.
Oh, Noon, but if obviously, you shut down the marketing industry, it would be total chaos.
Uh-huh. How would people realize that they needed new shoes that are slightly different from their current ones?
I was going to say Spanx, but yeah, either shoes or Spanx works.
Uh-huh. So as far as full unemployment goes, there are two kind of main proposals for how to get there. So one is to reduce the number of days a week, and the other is to reduce the number of work hours per day. And this was a major goal for radicals and particularly unionists, basically up until the Great Depression and then World War II. And over the, like, decade or two but of the Great Depression and World War II, this basically completely stopped being part of what unions were calling for. I'm not sure if I've said this on the show before, but the only thing that has ever made me consider voting for the Labour Party after Julia Gillard was a bumper sticker, which is impressive because I don't think anyone's been convinced of anything by a bumper sticker before. But it said, "The Weekend." It says, "The Labour Party, brought to you by the people who did The Weekend." And that's totally right, right? Like, The Weekend was not, it didn't exist until unions demanded it. And so we can easily demand, we should be demanding a 3-day weekend and then a 4-day weekend and then a 5-day weekend. So, yes, that's the full unemployment goal. Full automation is kind of the other side of that, right? So full unemployment is reducing the supply of labor. Automation is reducing the demand for labor. And again, full is not really an accurate word, where it's actually as much as is feasible. And the reason that we're not automating more stuff already, because we have most of the technology to automate a lot of jobs, the main reason that we're not doing it is that it's cheaper to hire labor. And so by doing things like reducing the workday or the work week and increasing minimum wage, we can incentivize businesses to automate much, 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 much faster. And the universal basic income, which is the third demand, is sort of ties these together. And again, these four proposals, although they can be thought of separately, all go together to create this outcome where the wage relation is destroyed and thus capitalism is, like, destroyed. So the universal basic income is a really complex topic, and it could be a whole episode in itself. There's lots of different models. There's lots of, like, shitty reactionary versions of it. But it can basically allow people to be selective about what jobs they take and therefore reduce the capacity for employment to be held as a threat over unemployed people, or sorry, unemployment to be held over threat of workers, and also to incentivize businesses to automate because they won't be able to find laborers to do the shitty jobs that no one really wants to do because people are going to not have to work to survive. And there's a quote here from page 120 of Inventing the Future. The UBI can unbind coercive aspects of wage labor, partially decommodifies labor, and thus transforms the political relationship between labor and capital. And what that's really saying is that it's about changing social relations. And social relations is basically the thing that Marx invented that blew open economics. There were a lot of things that he discovered, but his book Capital is subtitled A Critique of Political Economy, and it's not called a contribution to political economy, it's a critique. And I think the fundamental basis of his critique is that there are these social relations like selling your labor for wages or hiring people or buying a commodity at a shop. Those are all social relations that appear to be completely natural parts of what it is to be a human, but they're not. They're socially constructed. And that's not to say they're not real, but they're not sort of inherent in the world. And so this leads to the fourth demand, which is to diminish or destroy the work ethic. And I think that's about changing the social relationship internally. You know, people have so much guilt about not working. And I know this as someone who's been long-term unemployed and who, like, firmly believes all this anti-work shit. I still am like, oh, God, I'm a piece of shit. I'm a useless, dull-bludging, hippie whatever because I'm not selling my labor, destroying my body and mind. And
yeah, where's your community spirit, I think, man?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, someone said to me recently that they really admire that I live a life like the one that I do, and that was really touching to me because I think a lot of people kind of envy my layaboutism to an extent, but don't really, like, pursue it. Anyway, I think that we can all do a lot of stuff in our personal lives in terms of treating each other gently and, like, telling each other to take time and space in terms of diminishing and destroying the work ethic.
Absolutely. Well, this is something that has come up for me a little bit. I hope my partner doesn't mind that I talk about a little bit of personal stuff. But obviously, the corona has thrown a lot of people's employment and income financial situations into jeopardy. And there was a situation where basically a job opened up that my partner could potentially take, but she really didn't want to take it. It was just, it was going to be an awful job. And that situation may change later down the track. But, you know, basically, yeah, we're having this conversation and she was like, I really want to say no to this, but I don't feel like I can because I feel like I'm letting you down. And it's irresponsible of me to not take this work. And, yeah, it was just interesting to have a chat about those internalized feelings about the most important and worthwhile way of contributing to a relationship being pulling your weight financially or whatever. And feeling guilt about, like, prioritizing your, like, you know, her prioritizing her mental health over bringing money into the household or whatever. Yeah. And, you know, we're lucky enough that we're in a situation where it's like, you know, it's definitely not super financially desperate. My job is quite stable. So I was able to be like, it's absolutely okay. You know, we'll make do with what we have at the moment.
Sort something out.
But yeah, like this stuff is very real. Like these leave lasting kind of psychic scars on people, and people carry that guilt and shame of their, you know, of their relationship with work with them every day. So I think there's a huge amount to be said for the kind of positive mental health benefits, I suppose, long term of changing the way that we think about this stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. And as I say, like, it's fucked that even though consciously I can be like, this is what I believe, then I still have all of these, like, other deeply ingrained emotional responses that contradict that thing that I know that I believe. But, yeah. Just to finish up, we're nearly done. I just wanted to kind of briefly connect this a bit more to the coronavirus situation and why I thought about it. And probably some of that's pretty obvious is that, like, people are being unemployed and people are getting more welfare. So, like, in that sense, it's just that, like, two of these have been ticked. But I think that I'm not 100% sure about this, but anecdotally, I suspect people are vastly more efficient when working from home, because there's no busy work, there's no small talk, there's no hour and a half commute, there's no, like, desperately needing to avoid Janice. You know, like, I think most people, and obviously, like, people have different workflow situations or whatever, but, like, I think a lot of people are like, this is what I need to get done today, I get it done, and then, oh, it's 1:30, I'm gonna have a beer, and, like, I'll come back for the team meeting at 5 or whatever. And so that is reduced work hours with the same pay. That's, like, effectively reducing the number of hours in a workday while maintaining the same salary. So, and we're also seeing people automate where possible. And, like, it's kind of not the best example of it, but, like, us doing this podcast via distance recording and, like, all of this Zoom stuff and whatever, like, not only that's automating in a very small way, but, like, it cuts out so many unnecessary drivers and tram drivers and whatever.
That's true. It's also extremely inefficient and a huge hassle.
Yeah, but like...
Point nevertheless taken.
Nice NBN. Maybe it would be fucking sweet. But yeah, and like, you can imagine that if this situation continues, you know, if we don't find a cure and if the disease continues to get worse and the lockdown continues to get worse, I suspect we're going to see a big increase in like drone-based delivery. And I imagine there'll be other similar things that are going to get automated because it's just like the only way that you can really do stuff efficiently when you can't get humans in to do the labor.
Yeah, I think you, yeah. like... A lot of what you've talked about that's, you know, kind of discussed in this book is ways forward, things that make a kind of a lot of intuitive sense and that will kind of, as you say, happen relatively organically when capitalism reaches some kind of crisis. And that's what we're amongst, obviously.
What's going on?
Which is kind of what you were describing. I think it was last week or maybe the week before when we were talking about the current government's kind of reluctance to implement any kind of socialist policies because it goes against their ideology, despite the fact that I think you said, the way you put it was their ideology doesn't map onto reality. And so they've been pushed into a situation where they have to confront reality, and their response has been to implement, albeit very limited and reluctantly, these socialist policies or, you know,
social democratic
policies. But, you know, obviously, in a broader sense as well, this instability has brought about this kind of political moment where people are starting to talk about these ideas in a way that, you know, they're on the table in a way that they haven't been before. And we had just this week the National Union of Workers, which is a huge union. They've got like 150,000 members, I think, talking about universal basic income. And a jobs guarantee.
Yep.
And these are things that would just never have made, that, you know, they were obviously, they're on the agenda for certain unions and definitely
the
like
left
exactly,
or whatever. Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, the fact that these things are now being floated by big, important organizing bodies and are making headlines in national news is huge. And so, yeah, that's the other kind of, I guess, major connection here with the between the coronavirus and these new kind of radical non-reformist reforms that you're talking about, is that we are living through a political moment where it is more realistic than it has been probably in our entire preceding lifetimes that we actually make headway on getting this stuff done.
And I think also, you know... Obviously, this is not a moment where we can, like, gather in the streets and rally and march on Parliament and use collective action in that form. So I think having some vision of a way that we can get to a better future and a utopian future, to reference the food that we're eating this week, is important in a situation full of, like, despair and political confusion and, yeah.
Positivity. Corner.
Listeners, I hope you have enjoyed these utopian waffles. I think I've waffled on long enough, and it's time for us to finish up. But yeah, thank you very much for joining us yet again. And thank you, Zach. It's always good to do this. I'm sorry about the technical situation to both you and to the listeners.
Yeah, me
hopefully
too.
Hopefully next week we'll have a better one.
Yeah, we'll see what we can work out. Thank you very much for tuning in, everybody. We really appreciate it. I hope that everybody is staying as safe and well as they possibly can. And please do send in a little bit of audio describing something that has been making you feel good. Over the last couple of weeks, we really want to hear from you. We want to pull together, you know, a little bit of community positive energy to put back out into the world.
Yeah.
So we'd really appreciate it.
And you can also do regular potlucks as well if you want about other stuff. But yeah, we do want those positivity ones. So send that in.
Yeah. If you have something that's making you angry, do a full minute. Send us the potluck.
yeah, but we only want a little bit of positivity. It's just a corner.
Yeah, a little bit of positivity from everybody. Yeah, so thank you very much again for tuning in. You can follow us on Facebook at AusPulseNACPod. You can follow us on Twitter at AusPulseNACPod, Instagram at AusPulseNACPod. And if you love what we do and you want to support us, please share the podcast with a friend or leave us a review anywhere that you can do that. And if you are in the position to do so and you have the inclination, financial support is always appreciated, and you can do that over on Patreon, where if you support us for...
We're getting close to our...
Go on.
Sorry.
No, you go.
I was going to say, we're getting close to our 50 patron mark, and when we do that, we're going to do a little short-run series of Marxist theory where I explain dank Marxist theory memes to Zach. So we're getting pretty close. If you want to hear that, if you want more Marxism content, of which there's been a little smattering in this episode.
Yeah, if you enjoyed the last 30 minutes of Noon and the Dunce, then you're going to love this short-run series. Thanks for spending the time, Noon. I appreciate you little by little dragging me further and further to the left. Oh, well, I appreciate you in general, but I also appreciate you lending a little bit of academic and theoretical rigor to my general fuck the system feelings. And I'm sure that many of our listeners would agree with me on that. So
thanks, Zach. Do you want to tell us about next week?
Oh yeah, totally. I almost forgot about that. So next week we've got a special interview. I'm not going to give away who it is with, but Noon and I are going to do like a few of our regular segments. And then for mains, I'm going to be interviewing somebody from, this is going to sound really pretentious, but from the Melbourne like cultural underground. That is really pretentious, but it's not as pretentious as that sounds. It's going to be really fun.
But it's also true.
It is true. It's going to be really fun. It's going to be a very entertaining and also hopefully enlightening discussion about culture and performance and queerness and
politics.
Yeah, corporate co-option of the LGBT of LGBT allyship. There's going to be a whole bunch going on. So,
I'm excited. So Zach's going to be doing that interview without me. I'll be there for the first half and then I'll tap out because, what with the whole internet situation, we figured it's going to be much too hard to have all three of us on a call at once. So I'm excited to hear that when the episode comes out.
Yeah, we thought it'd be nice to bring you something that wasn't specifically corona-related. So, yes, please tune in for that. And I hope that everybody is well in the intervening week. Keep on snapping. Keep on snapping.
Snap, snap.
Keep on snacking in the free world. Noon already stopped recording. I'll do his bit. Crunch, crunch.